The Precinct Omega Weekly Podcast is supported by Horizon Wars Zero Dark, sci-fi skirmish war games in a fallen earth. Visit Wargame Vault at wargamevault.com and search for Zero Dark.
It's Friday the 5th of March. My name is Roby Jenkins, and this week was supposed to be a design discussion week, but as I said last week, I'm going to be sacrificing that discussion for a more structured review of the last 10 or so months of episodes. Now, obviously, doing a review like this after 12 months would be more sensible, but a few weeks ago, I did an episode on the post-Brexit VAT and customs regime that had scared so many traders and basically said there is nothing to worry about. And I wanted to make sure that if I had any feedback or any new points to pass on, that you guys got that information as soon as possible. And so I thought that made it the perfect opportunity to do a review of the last 10 months of podcasting and sort of revisit some topics that we've touched upon along the way. So before I get to VAT and customs, first I'm going to retread some of my most popular episodes of the last 10 months. So the most popular episode by far has turned out to be the one I did about Guild Ball, where it was called Last Whistle for Guild Ball, and we had a look at Steamforged Games and their background. So back in August, Steamforged Games announced an end to their popular fantasy sports war game, Guild Ball. To date, there has been no announcement of the future of that intellectual property, but SFG continues to produce new products. They have several computer game licenses for board game manufacture. Horizon Zero Dawn raised £1.4 million from over 10,000 backers and is due to fulfill by July this year, and everything looks on track. They also did a Devil May Cry Kickstarter, which raised $150,000 from 2,500 backers, and that completed fulfillment in January this year. Their Resident Evil board game got almost $900,000 from 7,500 backers, and an actual original intellectual property called Bardsung, although it is very Dungeons & Dragons inspired, raised over £1 million from 10,500 backers. So overall, that means that Steamforged Games has raised £7.5 million in Kickstarter funds in a little over a year, and they seem to be achieving a relatively consistent and swift fulfillment. However, it should be said, for all the success and gorgeous appearance of the games, reviews of actual gameplay are not complimentary. So, whilst SFG's revenue is looking good, it's hard to know to what extent that revenue is turning into the profit needed for the company to establish itself as a long-term prospect. My suspicion is that SFG will at some point be bought out, along with its many valuable licenses and the Guild Ball IP, by either Hasbro or Asmodee within the next 24 months or so. That said, there is a much larger story here that needs to be talked about in the context of my remarks last week on Come On Limited. In the weeks to come, I will definitely need to touch upon how companies using established IPs to kickstart board games for seven-figure sums are placing themselves at risk of being co-opted by major criminal enterprises. Now, I hasten to add, because I absolutely don't want to be sued, that I have no reason to believe that Steamforged or Come On are involved in this, but their business models are at risk, and we'll come back to this in a future episode. Okay, my second most popular, and I say most popular in the sense of most downloads, my second most downloaded episode of the last 10 months has been the one about AK Interactive. Now, do you remember their condemnation book? The one that showed you how to recreate the horrors of Nazi gas chambers and genocide in miniature form? Well, it's still for sale, but they have heard some of the criticisms, although I've no reason to believe they heard mine. Still, they have at least redone the covers to remove the prurient horror trope that they led with. They've stuck a parental advisory tag on the outside, and they've actually named the humanitarian charity to which a still unspecified portion of the proceeds of sales will be going. They have also changed the translation of the title. Now, you might recall that the book's original subtitle was When Modelling Becomes Art and Art is a Social Denounce. Well, although the product title on the website hasn't changed, if you look carefully at the new cover, the new subtitle of the English edition is When Modelling Becomes Art and Art is Social Commentary, which is at least English, albeit a very weak argument. Is art social commentary? Is military modelling art? And does replicating obscenities in miniature count as art? These are all questions that AK Interactive has declined to even engage with, let alone answer. And it's disappointing that they still brag that the book is the most provocative and compelling modelling book ever to be published. Well, that is bullshit, AK Interactive. You're still profiting from the glorification of human misery. Go yourselves. And the third most downloaded episode of the last 10 months has been another controversial topic, which was the question of black war games matter. Now, unsurprisingly, diversity in our hobby, or the lack thereof, is still a problem less than a year later. But we have seen more people of colour in the hobby being given more visibility and encouragement. Josh Mallett, whom I mentioned, aka Omegon Edge on Instagram, had 200 or 300 followers before BLM, and as a result of speaking out on the issue of diversity and racism in mainstream wargaming, now has almost 7,000 followers. Now, as far as I can tell, and very much to his credit, Josh isn't making any effort to monetize his modest celebrity. He's just about painting minis and playing games. If you are into Warhammer 30k, I highly recommend you follow him. If you're not, but you want to see a better representation of wargamers of colour, I also recommend that you follow him. But as for where diversity is going in wargaming, well, the lockdown has also brought a lost generation back into the hobby, with hundreds of men in their late 20s and early 30s picking up brushes to recapture a fascination from their adolescence. The millennial generation, Gen Y, is both more tolerant of and more sensitive to diversity, and far less tolerant of gatekeeping BS. So with people getting into the hobby in lockdown, venturing out to local clubs and stores as lockdown eases, we may see an uptick in both people of colour and women in the hobby in 2021, which would be a welcome trend. We're going to come back to this massive subject in more detail in a future episode, when I'm hopefully going to be joined by wargamers of colour from both sides of the Atlantic to share different perspectives of racism and gatekeeping in wargames, and what, if anything, has changed in the last 12 months. If you would like to contribute something to that episode, do let me know. Email me at precinctomega@gmail.com and I would love to set up a chat with you. Other episodes which garnered quite a lot of feedback and which I want to revisit are several episodes where I touched upon different aspects of what I call problematic products. Now, I mentioned these in a few episodes, products that could be argued to be misogynistic, sexualizing children, or encouraging racism and white supremacy. And this problem hasn't gone away in the last few months, obviously. But as I have been gearing up to release my own range of miniatures, a project that is now comfortably over 2 months behind its original schedule, but still steadily progressing, it has been very much on my mind as I look at my own approach and thinking. And as I get closer to a release of some sort, I will revisit the subject in detail to share some of my thoughts. And the other topic I wanted to give some feedback on, although I won't pretend it's been my, you know, sort of a highly downloaded episode, is the one on adverts and advertising. And this is why one shouldn't get too excited about success in any business, let alone a small enterprise like Precinct Omega. The return on my investment in advertising showed a rapid decline from its dramatic spike in December. In particular, I doubled down and placed an advert in Tabletop Gaming, which is Miniature Wargames' sister publication, which actually has a much larger circulation, and which regularly covers miniatures games to one extent or another. However, what I think I learned is important. First, I didn't see anything like the return on that investment, so I'll almost certainly not continue it, although I am keeping tabs. Looking at the magazine, though, I can now kind of see why. There are hardly any other quarter-page or half-page ads in the magazine compared to Miniature Wargames, which has a lot. There are several full-page ads, but even of these, at least half are promoting things that the magazine itself is doing. And this isn't at all because Tabletop Gaming is a bad magazine. In fact, if anything, I find its content more interesting than the content in Miniature Wargames. Whilst Miniature Wargames is focused on supplementary content, you know, scenarios, history articles, reviews of books that may not be directly connected to wargames, but which is going to have an intellectual interest to wargamers, Tabletop Gaming is essentially nothing but advertorials. It's largely uncritical content about new tabletop games. So advertising in Tabletop Gaming is about placing articles, not adverts. And on that note, in about a week, depending on when you listen to this, my own articles will start to feature in Miniature Wargames. So it'll be super interesting to see what kind of return I get from having multiple pages dedicated to the game and its content. Okay, so the last topic I was going to visit in a little detail, as mentioned at the start, was the one from a few weeks ago, which is VAT, duty and Brexit. Now, the good news is that so far, no one has pointed out any glaring errors in my podcast about the future of trade with Britain. And looking around, it seems like UK wargames traders and their overseas commercial partners have gradually begun to wake up from the initial shock and awe of the experience to agree with what I said, that fundamentally, not that much has actually changed for reals. And one thing that definitely has changed is the shipping times to and from the UK. So like I said in the podcast, despite the changes in regulations, no one is actually putting any more resources into our customs authorities. And so with more box ticking to be done than ever, shipments to and from the UK are being delayed from their usual shipment times by as much as 2 weeks or more. Now, one thing I've had questions about and didn't mention on the podcast was the shipment of books. Now, physical books are, as far as I can tell, universally zero rated for both duty and VAT, so you should be able to order books without extra charges wherever you are. But the aforementioned shipping delays will apply. So if you're a small business owner, be sure to put the commodity code for printed books onto your shipping documents to minimise those delays. Okay, now those are all of the major topics that I wanted to sort of revisit in detail, but I also wanted to use this episode as a chance to look back at some of the feedback I've had from listeners. Now, most of this has come from my patrons because they have the Patreon page on which to offer comments and feedbacks and then to engage with the dialogue about any of the podcasts. If you are listening on some other streaming service other than Patreon, you can put comments onto the Podbean page for the Precinct Omega podcast, which is podbean.precinct. No, I'm going to get this right. It's precinctomega.podbean.com. That's what it is. I ought to know that, really, oughtn't I? Precinctomega.podbean.com. I'm pretty sure that's what it is, not the other way around. Either way, just search for Precinct Omega and Podbean and you'll find it. Anyway, you can comment on there. Now, there is a little bit of a drawback because I can't respond to comments on the Podbean blog using a web browser. I have to use the app on my phone, which means it's harder to reply to comments at length and in detail. If you would like to offer comments, however, on any of my episodes from now on in the future, or any that you've listened to in the past, you can always email me at precinctomega@gmail.com. I love to get feedback, love to get your thoughts, and I am very happy to engage in a private conversation if you'd like to discuss any issues offline. Right. Some feedback I have had. Right. Okay, dice. We talked about dice and random number generators a few episodes back. One listener pointed out that I said that 2d6 is a bell curve. Technically, they say it doesn't create a bell curve. Rather, it creates a gently sloping mountain peak. It's a straight line up and then a straight line down the other side. And that is graphically 100% true. The more dice you add as you go from 2d6, 3d6, 4d6, etc., the more curvy the graph becomes. So I'm going to say that 2d6 is the birthplace of what will eventually become a recognisable bell curve. So what that does is it puts the 2d6 graph on the bell curve of bell curves. And I'm going to call that one a score draw. If you missed my live stream a few weeks ago, I did a little mini demo of the mechanics for Kobolds and Cobblestones by Rob Berman, published by Osprey in their Blue Book series. The game uses playing cards extensively and exclusively as its random number generator, which I talked about being an untapped mechanic in that episode about random number generators. It was really interesting, very interesting. My conclusions are in the live stream. You can see the video on my Facebook page. That's facebook.com/precinctomega. Look at the videos, scroll through until you find the one about kobolds and cobblestones. And last of all, if you're interested in random number generators and dice, I am going to be publishing a series of articles on my blog over the next few weeks, looking at different dice, what I like about them, and what I don't. If you want to find my blog, it's at precinctomega.co.uk and click through to the blog. I don't blog frequently, but I'm trying to do it more often. Okay, another topic that I've had some feedback on has been my commentary on Conquest Last Argument of Kings, hitherto referred to just as Conquest, and having been pretty down on these guys for most of last year, I am starting to revise my position in response to feedback from the community. Now, I need to emphasise that I have no axe to grind with Parabellum. I'm sure they are fine people. My expectation, though, was that they were being bankrolled to success by a third party and that that well would run dry, leaving the company to quietly fold and go away. However, looking back into the history of games companies, I think I underestimated how long that would actually take. And I think the brains behind Parabellum's marketing strategy may well have been more accurate than me. With the right financial underpinning, it really takes a company in this market 5 years to become established, after which it must sink, swim, or find something else to do with itself. Now, we saw this in Spartan Games, Hawk War Games, Privateer Press, Steamforged Games, GCT Studios, and others. As Parabellum's clock truly started ticking in 2018, I reckon they have at least another 2 years in which to find their feet, and to be fair, they seem to be doing okay. I'm still sceptical about their chances and about some of their decisions, but I think they will see it to the end of the coming financial year with a solid product range. And in fact, this week they've just announced a new faction for the game, which is a undead faction. Now, I haven't seen any miniatures for it, just artwork, but it looks like a solid concept. If they can continue to pivot that into loyal repeat customers, they could well become a permanent feature of our topography, and by doing so, achieve something remarkable. One interesting additional factoid I picked up about them, though, is that Alessio Cavatore is the writer for their rules. Now, Alessio is a fine rules writer, but an interesting thing about his style is that he tends to write with one eye firmly on a competitive play environment. So it might well be that in order to drive interest, Parabellum is going to begin to pitch a competitive tournament circuit for a fantasy battle game, something which there really hasn't been since Warhammer Fantasy Battle 8th edition. The Kings of War, the first edition of which was also written by Alessio, attempted to do much the same before largely backing away from it. And we've looked before at the impact of a tight and competitive tournament scene on games like Guild Ball, Malifaux and Infinity. So watch this space. Another topic I raised that got a lot of feedback from listeners was the question of manufacturing and materials, which I looked at a few weeks ago. I was surprised by how few of my listeners share my enthusiasm for white metal as a material, and by how many are big fans of 3D printing. Now, I would say there's no accounting for taste, but the truth is that every manufacturer has to reach a decision about what's best for them based on their capital, their sales forecasts, and of course their in-house expertise. Now, much as I personally like white metal, that doesn't stop me buying great minis in resin and plastic. And when I do eventually buy a 3D printer, I will certainly print minis as well. But I think we have to be aware of the risks of accidentally gatekeeping our hobby by encouraging the shift to 3D printing. It reminds me a lot of airbrushes. There was a time when none of the best hobby painters used airbrushes, but now they've become an essential tool for anyone wanting to paint at the highest levels. But a good airbrush, compressor, and the maintenance equipment to go with them are really bloody expensive, and it worries me that we now unintentionally tell new and particularly young or low-income hobbyists that there's an entry fee to the upper tiers of talent. Now, 3D printing runs the risk of the same thing on a much larger scale, potentially putting future access to our hobby out of the reach of people who can't afford to own or run their own 3D printer. Now, those of us who can afford it should be wary of stockpiling STLs against future needs that are going to drain resources from physical manufacturers. And manufacturers who make high-quality STLs should remember that providing a physical item option keeps the gates open to the less well-off, which keeps our hobby diverse and accessible to everyone's ultimate benefit. But from that same episode, I did have some corrections and some extra info. So first up, multiple sources confirmed my recollection that RTB-01 Space Marines were 30 for £10, and also added that Land Raiders were 2 for a tenner and Rhinos were 3 for a tenner. So for £30, you got 3 mounted squads of Marines and 2 main battle tanks. However, you could also buy a semi-detached home in Hampshire for £50,000. So, you know, perspective. However, I did say that the plastic skeletons came first, and while it's true that they came out before the Space Marines, they were preceded by several inferior polystyrene fantasy kits. Now, I'm going to defend my position slightly, though, because I am pretty sure that those kits were third-party goods rebranded by Games Workshop. The skeletons, I am 99% sure, were the first fully in-house plastic kit developed by GW themselves. I also made a mistake. I said that moulds for resin minis were made from latex rubber when I meant, of course, silicone, specifically RTV silicone rubber, which has a high heat resistance because when you mix the two chemicals needed to make resin, they have a powerful exothermic reaction. Right, okay. Quick one on Cyberpunk. A game I should have mentioned in the Cyberpunk episode is Chromehammer by Jason Smith, published by Nordic Weasel. My thanks to Marco Rinaldi for pointing that out. And talking of forgotten games, in the Digital and Tabletop Hybrids episode, we had some discussion afterwards about, after I'd finished speaking to Dr. Thomas Rawlings from Auroch Digital, I did talk about some other games that had attempted to do digital tabletop hybrids. One which I didn't mention, I was reminded of by Andy Strauss. Thank you, Andy. Which was Golem Arcana. This was a super successful Kickstarter. At the time, it was one of the most successful tabletop Kickstarters there had been, with pre-painted minis that required a tablet app to work. But like Ex Illis, the game died incredibly quickly. It released in 2014, and after 2016, it had no further updates, and the app is no longer supported. The game is essentially not only dead, but unplayable, illustrating a major drawback to hybrids that rely upon their hybrid nature to work, as opposed to, which is what I think I was talking about in the episode, which was using the digital hybrid as an optional extra to the analog game. Okay, I had design episode a few weeks ago about turns. A bunch of folks, amongst whom was Dale Platt, told me that I had overlooked options besides Igo, Yugo, and the integrated turn, and there are two that I would like to pick up from their feedback. One was random activation, and the other was phased activation. Now, phased activation is when players have Igo, Yugo, but split by phase. So one player does all of their movement, then the other does all their movement, then one does all of their shooting, and the other does all of their shooting, etc., working through the phases until you're finished. Now, I know that there are games that do this, but my gut reaction is, why would you? It feels to me like a method that manages to avoid the advantages of either Igo, Yugo, or alternating activation without basically adding anything new. It does have a good tempo, but I think it's a tempo that is better suited to board games or very abstract war games. That said, if someone would like to persuade me that there's a good reason for phased activation in a miniatures war game, I am absolutely listening. Meanwhile, more relevantly, I should talk briefly about random activation, best known for most wargames from Bolt Action, in which players alternate activating units by drawing coloured dice from a bag. Pardon me. Now, it's funny that I missed this, because Horizon Wars Infinite Dark, that I am poised to release, uses a random activation phase, a random activation system. I guess in my defence, I do think of this as essentially a variation of alternating activation. It might be thought of as alternating activation plus, because it has the advantages of alternating activation with the additional benefit of having to always account for the possibility that you get a good or bad run of activations, which does usefully illustrate something of the fog of war. That said, don't take that plus aspect as meaning that I think random activation is de facto better than pure alternating activation. It's a turn system that should be used cautiously because it does inject an additional component of randomness that can easily turn on a player, giving them the impression that they are being unfairly punished for something over which they have no control. I'm just looking at my notes here. So I had feedback from Jonathan Lupton. In fact, to be fair, I had a lot of feedback from Jonathan, who is the most enthusiastic feedback provider to my podcast episodes. Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate every word you write. But I've got one message which I was going to read in full. This is relating to a couple of episodes where I talked about art and game design, and then the process of commissioning art. Jonathan wrote, "I find it odd that to play a miniature war game you don't need art. The game is playable without it. However, successful games do have good or great art. In fact, the art can be more important to the success than the rules themselves. Miniature companies that can combine their sculpts, art, background and rules into a single coherent product are typically the more successful ones. How do you and other mini-agnostic companies like Precinct Omega find the right balance between creating the art that evokes the world universe of Horizon Wars but still remains open enough that players can use any miniatures?" Right, okay. So to answer that question directly, The obvious answer is you make the art generic. That is, to mix styles, aesthetics, and of course artists in a way that lets them express whatever vision they have of the future without any reference to the rules. But, if I may, I have come to think that this is actually a mistake. I think rule sets can be generic without having a generic vision of themselves. Now, Jonathan's dead right. Games with a coherent product are more successful commercially than ones that aren't, and most long-lived games that began with a generic setting have pushed themselves into more and more well-defined aesthetics over the years, best example being Dungeons & Dragons. The reason for this is that art is a part of the imaginative process. It helps the reader of the rules to visualise what play should feel like. I've talked about this before, that designers need to have an idea in mind of not only how a game should play, but also about how they expect the players to engage imaginatively with the experience. What, if you like, play should feel like. And art is a vital tool to prime the mind and the imagination. The more coherent the art, the fuller the image that the players get to enjoy. Now, for Horizon Wars, I began with as generic a vision as I had a rule set, but I've gradually crystallised it into something more specific. I'm now working on developing a very coherent vision for the Horizon Wars setting, with art, fiction and miniatures combining into one thing, but the rules will stay generic in perpetuity. And I think it's fascinating to compare how players engaged with Horizon Wars with how they engaged with Zero Dark. Hardly anyone plays the earlier game with the setting packaged in the book, but lots of people have really engaged with the story of Zero Dark, despite neither game requiring it. Now, from Oliver, I had a query about, related to the art episode, employment law, which long-term listeners may know is my personal professional background. He and I had a discussion, and I'm going to summarise that here. So, basically, it arose from me mentioning that small business owners and game developers should be careful of employing artists so consistently that they become employees by default, and mentioned that you could avoid this by employing a limited company rather than a sole trader. Now, Oliver pointed out, correctly, that making an employee into a company to avoid treating them as employees is against the law. And he is technically absolutely correct. And as we all know, technically correct is the best form of correct. If you already have a team of employed artists and you fire them and outsource the work to them as limited companies with all of the same expectations and conditions as before, then you are a scummy tax dodger who deserves everything they get. And yes, Uber, Deliveroo, Pimlico Plumbers and Hermes, I am looking at you. However, I was talking about small businesses that don't have their own in-house art teams, who are looking at establishing a relationship with an artist or group of artists to be their primary suppliers of art. In that case, if the quantity of art you're going to expect to be commissioning would be enough to keep that artist in continuous, regular employment, you are well advised to work with a company, not a sole trader, in order to keep the legal relationship completely transparent. If, however, and as is much more likely, it's just going to be a few pieces every now and then, don't worry about it. Okay. That is not all the feedback I have had from listeners to the podcast, but that is all the feedback I could really fit into this episode. I have skipped over loads of episodes where particularly the patrons and I had a great chat about the content. If there was a subject you think I should have revisited in this episode and didn't, please let me know. It's all material for a future episode. Next week, I'll be back to the news, and after that, another design discussion, and I'm going to talk about the challenges of army building, point systems, and balance in wargames. It's a big topic, so it could easily roll over into two episodes. Don't forget that I live stream every Friday afternoon on Facebook from 2 until 3 p.m. Universal time, so that's UK time at the moment. It would be great to see you there. If not, I will, of course, speak to you again next week.
The Precinct Omega Game Design Podcast is supported by our patrons on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/Precinct Omega to help us continue developing new games and creating hobby content for wargames enthusiasts all over the world.